Yeah, now everyone is sort of settled down. I can give this evening's talk. And I had an email earlier and also a request which seemed to fit together. Somebody gave an email from Canada, asked me, how can you distinguish the different types of happiness in our world? And she's a Buddhist and understands that some happinesses you shouldn't really get attached to, or they may be counterproductive, but many people in life, they say, well, you know, drinking alcohol makes me happy, why not? Or having a mistress makes me happy, what's wrong with that? Or just gambling or going to the casino, that makes me happy, so what's the big deal? Why, you Buddhists say all this thing is wrong? And for many people in life, that they ask those questions and they say, well, can you sort of be a religious person, a Buddhist, and still have a happy time? Or is religion all about putting away your happiness in this life, hoping somehow or other to pick the right horse and get happy after you die by going to the heaven? And a lot of times people ask these questions, and one of the reasons why they think religion is irrelevant in our world is because it doesn't address the problems of basic happiness and how to deal with the problems in life. And this also can coincide with another question about the place of laughter in our world, especially in religions. Should religions laugh more? And I think you know my attitude towards that, but nevertheless, that's the subject of today's talk, about some more information and understanding about what happiness is, and also just, you know, how to be happy, and what happiness can sometimes be a bit dangerous for you, and what happiness can sometimes be happy for you, can be beneficial for you and for others. So it's about happiness and laughter. But to begin with, just that I made a point at the beginning there that sometimes people think that happiness has to be put off into the future. That, you know, we try hard, we sort of give lots of donations, we work hard for others, we sacrifice ourselves for our family, for our kids or for society, thinking that somehow or other if we're a good person, then when we die, then we'll become happy and go to a heaven realm. And for many people, that meant religion in the old days. And sometimes they think, well, you can't really be really sure, because in some religions you say you have to blow yourself up before you go to heaven. And other places they say, no, you just go to church before you go to heaven. And some religions they say, no, you can do whatever you like as long as the last moment that you have the right thoughts, then you go to heaven. And that's actually what Buddhism says. Just all you have to make sure of is the last moment is a really good and pure one, and then you go to heaven afterwards. So I'd mentioned that to many people, and many people think, oh, great, what a wonderful teaching that is. Because all it means is that I can really misbehave, I can have mistresses, I can get drunk, I can take alcohol, I can cheat on my taxes, as long as I get away with it. And the last minute before I die, I must remember to think of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Buddha, Savanagachami, Dhamma, Savanagachami, Sangha, Savanagachami, and then you beat the system and go to heaven. However, it doesn't work that way. And fortunately, that during the retreat which I was teaching just over a week ago, so that's why I wasn't here the last two Fridays, someone told me a nice story about this. And it's a story which he got from the Hindu tradition, but I've adapted it to Buddhism. And it's a great little story about this man who used to come to Nolamara temple very often. But then he started to get very busy, because you know what life is like, you know, getting a business together and getting on in the world and being able to pay off your mortgage and then buy a bigger house afterwards. And that was his life. He had a nice little business, but he came along and said, well, yeah, I've got to remember Buddhang Savanangachami, Dhammang Savanangachami, Sanghang Savanang, to think of the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha at the last moment of my life. And how could he do that? So he went to the monk, and the monk said, well, if you keep coming to the temple every week and keep meditating and listening to Dharma talks, it's like conditioning you, you get brainwashed. And so obviously you've been training yourself to actually to remember the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha when you die. But he thought, that's no good. I can't spend all this time away from my shop, you know, just in the temple. So he decided on a really brilliant idea to beat the system. We're always looking for ways, aren't we, to beat the system. And this particular way to beat the system, his wife was pregnant, And so when she gave birth, she thought, I'll name my first son Buddha. And then when she got another child, I'll name her Dhamma. And a third child, named it Sangha. Because that way, he'd always be thinking about Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha throughout his whole life. So certainly, when he died, he must be thinking about Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And that way, he didn't need to come to the temple. He could do whatever he liked and be sure of going to heaven afterwards. However, these things never work out the way we think they should. Because what actually happened? At his deathbed, and he knew he'd been a really scallywag all his life and never really helped anyone and just was into business. But his three children were there. His son, first son Buddha, first daughter, Dhamma, and his third son, Sangha. And so he saw them there, and he was thinking, now I've got my children here, that's all I'm thinking about, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, I must go to heaven. But as he was looking at them just before he died, he thought, my goodness, if my two sons, Buddha and Sangha, and my daughter Dhamma is here, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, I wonder who's looking after the shop. And that's when he died. So, that's what happened. You cannot beat the system. The point is, your last thought is what you've been thinking about all your life. You can't suddenly change. So you can't beat the system that way. The only way to beat the system is actually to learn gradually throughout your life. So it's your inclination, that's your tendency. As the Buddha once said, if a tree has been leaning to the west, then when it's cut down, it will fall to the west. Or when it dies or is blown down. If it's been leaning to the east, then it's going to fall down to the east when it dies. So it's whichever way you're inclining, that's the way you'll go. So it's important to understand which way to incline so we can become happy after we die. But if we incline to real happiness now, then we'll incline to real happiness after we die. And it's not the case that what you're doing now is somehow different to what will happen to you after you die. Because life is a continuum. It doesn't suddenly change. It's always flowing in a direction. Sure, you can veer it off in another direction, but that takes a lot of time and effort to change. But the point is here that it's what one does now is where we build our future. As I said in the meditation, it's by caring about this present moment you're actually building your future. So we don't have to wait and worry about whether we're going to go to heaven when we die and what should we do at our last moment. It's what we're doing now is always a big thing. And this is where we understand what happiness is. You know, if we want to go to a happy place, we have to understand happiness now, how to build up that happiness. And by building that up the happiness, the real happiness in this life, obviously we're going to go to a happy life afterwards. Miserable people, if you've been inclining towards misery, grumpiness, anger, fault-finding, and of course that's where you're going to go after you die, the fault-finding hell, where whatever you see is never good enough. Now the story here is about what actually happiness is and how we can discern the different types of happiness. I've said before, and this is a very reasonable description of what most people find is happiness, but it's not the full story. And sometimes we say that happiness is just a space between two moments of suffering, and suffering is a space between two moments of happiness. And you can understand that in your life whenever you've been working very hard all week and it comes to Friday, at last I'm free, and that's very happy. Or sometimes when one's on a meditation retreat. On some of the retreats, which I haven't taught these, but I've seen other people teach, because they're very tough retreats where you have to get up a certain time in the morning and you have to meditate for 15 minutes, and if you don't get up, someone is sent to actually to get you out of bed and shame you, and you have to walk at a certain time, you have to do everything according to a schedule. And sometimes in those retreats, they only take the group photograph at the very end, because that's the only time when everyone is smiling because they're about to go home. But unfortunately, that's not a good indication of what meditation is supposed to be doing. It's not at the end of your meditation we should take the photograph. It's in the middle, actually, what's actually happening. And so that it's true that sometimes in our life it's when a difficulty, a sickness, a problem is finished. We take that as being happiness. And for many of you, that's what happiness is, going on the holidays. Alas, I've finished work. The Friday night, alas, I don't have to go to work. Or when you get sick, or they pay off the mortgage, or whenever else is an end of a difficulty. When you, like the schoolies week, or a couple of weeks ago, when you finally finish being at school, then people let go of their morality and their virtue and everything else. And they sort of have a good time, what they think is a good time. So a lot of times, that what we take to be happiness is just like an end of a difficulty or problem. However, there's something much more than that, because in Buddhism we say that's just like the waves on an ocean. They go up and they go down. They have their peaks, they have their troughs. But is that all there is to life? Is just, you know, trying to find the peaks and just trying to get out of the troughs whenever they get too low for us? Is there something else? And what I've noticed, certainly in the sort of life which I lead, surely there are the peaks and the troughs, and the peaks are just the spaces between two troughs. But something else happens in life also, and that's the whole raising of the average level of the water. And this is something which is very fascinating to observe. Sure, that as we learn about happiness, we learn about sort of the spirituality which eases the problems and makes you more happy. The average level rises higher and higher and higher. So actually there is a way of understanding the happiness of life. Sure, you have one's peaks and troughs, but the average level, if you know what you're doing, actually increases and increases and increases and increases. It's fascinating to see that. You become happier people all the time. I just come back from Kuala Lumpur. I did an overnight, left on Wednesday, came back early this morning. That's my lifestyle these days. So when I was there yesterday morning, I gave a talk on enlightenment, just mentioning that a quote which I got from Werner Heisenberg. He was one of the founders of quantum physics, the fellow who gave his name to the famous Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And he was quoting, many of you have heard quantum physics, but you think it's just so deep and hard to explain. But his quote was, if I can't explain this to a barmaid in a pub, then I don't understand what I'm talking about. There's a wonderful little saying there, from something as difficult and complicated as quantum physics. He said he knew it so well, he could go to a pub, and the girl serving the beer behind the bar, he could explain it to her and she would understand it. And in a talk which I gave yesterday, I mentioned that and I said, if this like nirvana, enlightenment, the goal of this path we're supposed to be practicing as Buddhists, then surely that if you really know what you're talking about, you should be able to explain it to people so they understand. And one of the explanations which I gave that day was like the Buddha said, nirvana is the ultimate happiness. So you know what happiness is. And you've had various types of happiness in life. And the Buddha is saying nirvana is the ultimate, the highest one of those. So if you're going to go to the highest happiness, like walking up to the highest mountain, surely as you're walking towards the peak, you must get higher and higher and higher and higher. And that's actually the indication whether you're actually going up or you're going down, whether you're getting closer and closer to ultimate happiness. So the path really, if you're going for nirvana, should be getting happier and happier and happier and happier. Otherwise, we're going in the wrong direction. So I said that if one understands nirvana, or nirvana as the ultimate happiness, then you can understand also the path is about becoming happier and happier and happier. And I mentioned that because the night before, on Wednesday night, I was giving a talk again in Kuala Lumpur, and the monk who's giving me the introduction said that Ajahn Brahm is a very happy monk, he's always smiling, and he said that this is what we should do these days, this is modern Buddhism, that in the past monks were very serious, but today we should be happy. And I took him to task and said, that's not true. Even the time of the Buddha, the monks and the nuns were happy people. And I quoted like a text from 2,500 years ago, where the king went to visit the Buddha, and he said to the Buddha that one of the reasons I like coming to this monastery is because all the monks in this monastery are always smiling and happy. And the Buddha replied, yes, king, that's what you can expect if people are practicing the path, meditating, and getting closer to enlightenment. You expect it to get happier. So this path, which we're teaching here, should lead to greater and greater happiness. Otherwise, it's not really the path. So we understand what actually is a happiness which can really rise the level of our average, so that we can understand what true happiness is. And obviously, people come to places like this to get some indications, some guidelines, which is really what they should know already. But nevertheless, we need those guidelines and inspiration so that we can somehow understand what happiness is and how it can really be achieved. And one of the things which I've noticed as a way of happiness is actually living a good life, a virtuous life. It's one thing which the Buddha actually said, that people live virtuous lives, get happier and happier. You've got what's called a blameless happiness. But that type of happiness, the blameless happiness, that sometimes we have to understand where it's actually coming from. And why do people, you know, who live within a boundary of like a precepts or virtue, why is it that they actually do actually become happier? Why do we have rules by which we agree to live? And the underlying reason for that is realizing what rules are all about. In Buddhism, as I've mentioned many times, the underlying philosophy of virtue is not doing anything which harms another person or harms yourself. What I call the two precepts. Usually in Buddhism, people have to keep five precepts. But people being very busy, and also not being able to count to five these days because of OBE, education, or whatever else, that these days at least we can count till two. And we remember the two precepts. If you live by the two precepts, then you're on the right path. Never do anything which harms another person or being. Never do anything which harms yourself. What beautiful precepts those are. Because what that means is we never do any killing or any stealing or even lying. Because that hurts other people. And eventually it hurts yourself. What do you want to do that for? Or even like taking drugs or ecstasy. If a kid comes up and says, what's wrong with this? It's fun. You use that. Is it actually harming somebody or harming yourself? Say, it's my body. I can do what I like with it. If I want to kill myself, that's my business. That's my right. But when we actually see just in those situations, does it harm another person or harm yourself? There's always many, many people who care. If they see someone who's killed themselves through drugs or committed suicide or whatever, even if it may not be your parents who care, there's still many, many other people who feel very sad to see a young person die that way. And I put my hand up for being one of those. We understand that we are not alone in this world. Where if one goes to a hospital or any sort of rehabilitation center, there's so many people there who care about a person they've never known. They still care. When you understand just if you harm yourself, you always will harm other people. You become sad to see you in pain, sad to see you dying, sad to see you wasting a life. Understanding that, how we do interact with each other, gives us the understanding that harming ourselves is harming many other people. It doesn't make sense. However, helping somebody else, or even helping yourself, making yourself peaceful and happy, that helps an enormous number of people. Which is why that people come here. They don't just come to the places like this for personal improvement. They come over here as an act of compassion for all the people who have to put up with you in life. When you become more peaceful and soft and happier, the people who have to live with you at home, even your dog and cat benefits from you being a kinder, more peaceful person, let alone the people you work with. And so you understand in our life that what we do to ourselves does affect other people. So this is our virtue. By making ourselves happier, more peaceful, more free, less problem, less sick, we're helping so many other people. And by helping other people, we give inspiration to ourselves. And you find that what I thought was virtue is not a code imposed upon you inside. It's just the first lesson in what happiness is. comes to my mind that when I was at university, one day every week I used to go to a local hospital, Forborn Hospital, outside of Cambridge, just to help out with some social work with children who had Down syndrome. I went there every Wednesday afternoon during the term time. And I went there for 2 years during term time, never missing once. I was told afterwards that of all the student volunteers they had, I'd always stayed there the longest, kept going the most. And just before the final examinations, they gave me a gift, like a presentation. That's where they told me that, you know, you're the longest serving student volunteer we've ever had here. And it was very, very moving, actually, to be told that and get all these Down syndrome kids you got to know over 2 years making little presents for you. And you know what a Down syndrome child is like. They can't do very much, but they really tried, because this was supposed to be my last time there. And after giving me a formal presentation, almost reducing me to tears, then I had to ask them. I said, actually, my final examinations are not to another 10 days. Can I please come back next week? So I went there after my final farewell ceremony for another week. Not because I had to, not because I was being a goody-goody, not because I was trying to get to heaven in some future life. It was because I was actually enjoying it. I got a lot of fun doing that sort of, it's supposed to be service, but I was getting too much out of it to really call it service. And I understood what happiness was. Sure, I could have just hung out with my mates or gone down to the pub or had some sex or something, but serving actually made me happier. So I start to understand what this happiness truly is and what joy really is, just from my experience. And so when I started reading some of the Buddha's teachings, and the Buddha was actually saying the same, if you're generous, it's not to sort of be, to get your name in lights and think how virtuous I am and think that, you know, you're going to go to heaven after you die. It's because you get happiness now. And some of the times I've seen people giving donations and being kind and how hard they work for a cause, my goodness, that brings tears to my eyes. What I've seen in my life, how generous and kind people can be. You know, the greatest acts of generosity I've ever seen so far in my life as a monk, I'll tell you what it is now. That once I was cleaning up in our hall in Thailand, and as I was cleaning up in the afternoon, just by myself, I was behind a cupboard when I heard somebody run into the hall. I thought it was a burglar. Because sometimes there's very many poor people in these villages in Thailand, and sometimes they're so desperate they steal even from a temple. So I put my head around the cupboard, and there I saw a girl I recognized. She was one of the villagers who was mentally impaired. She could not speak, she could only grunt. But her grunts, because she's grown up in a village and other people have grown up with her, the children of her age could understand exactly what each grunt meant. It was her own language. And because of her mental impairment, she would never find a husband nor be able to get a job. But she was always cared for by the villagers. It's wonderful to see how village life would be able to accept and embrace such people without needing to send them to any institutions. They're just part of things and never exempted. And I thought, in one sense, that was a lucky person to have such an impairment, but in a village society where everybody cares for you. But it was her who ran into the hall, and I saw her look around. She didn't spot me, thank goodness, and she left something on the altar. And I was very intrigued to find what on earth she was doing. And she ran out again. Obviously, she was doing something, and she didn't want anybody to see it. But I saw. And I went up to the altar, and I found that she'd made a little folded painted lotus. Now, lotus is one of the symbols of Buddhism, and she put that on the altar in front of the Buddha statue. When I looked upon it, it wasn't well done, nor well coloured. It was what maybe like a 5 or 6 year old child would be able to do, and she was in her probably late 20s or early 30s. But because I'd been in that monastery part of that village for such a long time. I knew that girl, and I knew how hard it was for her to make a lotus like that. And I realized why she was so ashamed that it might be rejected, that she chose a time in the afternoon when no one is usually in that hall, and she ran in like a burglar. She didn't want to steal the money. She just wanted to steal the chance of making an offering, her offering, to a Buddha statue, because she was afraid it was not good enough. And when I understood why she made such an offering and how hard it was for her to do it, even now remembering it, I get teary-eyed. Of all the offerings which I have seen in my life as a monk, and sometimes people are given hundreds of thousands of dollars, that is the best I've ever seen. Because it was so hard to do, and so beautiful. And afterwards I told the other monks, even though I was not the head monk there, I was about third or fourth in line, I told even the senior monks, even if they touch and move and throw away that lotus, they might see me very angry at them. Because I realized just how precious that was, and how beautiful and wonderful it was. Not as a piece of paper, but from where it came from. That inspires me even now. And then I understand from that inspiration what happiness truly is. It doesn't matter about money. It's where it's come from. It's the heart of kindness and generosity and goodness. And those are the things which inspire us in life and what real happiness means. So that's not a happiness which is dependent upon just the end of some suffering. It's not like the space between two moments of trial and tribulation. It's much different than when you finally win the lotto, or when you, you know, have some sex, or you sort of go on a bender and get really drunk, or you go and see your most famous rock star. Apparently, who's that guy in town now? Robbie Williams. Yeah, you can go and see Robbie Williams, but you sort of do an act of kindness like that, and that's much, much happier, much more beautiful. And can't you feel that? And it's from that mindfulness, that introspection, understanding from our experience, what really inspires us is actually what we learn about what happiness is. And to me, what happiness really is, the real happiness, is the happiness based on letting go, on giving up things, on abandoning, and doing things for, not for others, but for us. Because I'm really against this doing things for others business now, but doing things for us. That we're all in this together, and it's like a community lifting up of the beauty and bliss of life. And I gave this piece of advice to somebody today who came, who had motor neuron disease, and she came to have a chat with me. And I picked up her main fear pretty quickly. And her main fear was what will happen to her when she loses all her ability to care for herself, when she has to be supported and looked after by other people. And like many of you, you would not like to be a burden on others, and to lose all your independence, and to be just someone who even has to have their bum wiped. And I told her that, you know, the later parts of the progress of your disease, whatever it's called, it's one of the most beautiful moments to be there bedridden, and to have all these wonderful people come and care for you. To look there and say that now I am dependent and I need you, and to see all these amazing people come and spend so much time and effort caring for you. I said, in those later times of your disease, you're going to be like a flower which at last opens and attracts all these beautiful butterflies and bees who come to you. And you're part of this beautiful moment of someone in need being cared for. If you didn't need anybody, they wouldn't care. That's what happens in a life, isn't it? And she was starting to nod and cry, because ever since she told her friends and relations that that was going to be her future, the debilitating sickness of motor neuron disease, they came up with such kindness and such care that it blew her away. She never realized people cared so much. And the only sadness was that she had to have that illness before people expressed what was already in their hearts. And I said, what a wonderful gift it is you are giving to other people, to allow them to show their love and to allow them to express their love in their care for you. And that's a beautiful time when you're sick. So you don't need to be thinking, oh, I'm going to be a burden on other people. You are a blessing on other people. I told her the story, which I read a long, long time ago, and I can't find the reference for it. If anyone finds this reference, please let me know, because I'd like to note it down. It was a story about the Dalai Lama when he was still in Tibet. And because he was a leading figure there, he would try and look after the people, even going to the most remote villages in the country. Wherever he would go, actually people would line up to give him things, to make good karma or something. And at this particular time, there was an American journalist who was actually going with him on his journeys. And as he was seeing all these poor people giving the Dalai Lama all these gifts, he started thinking like a Westerner and thinking, this is wrong. Now, this is a Dalai Lama. He lives in a palace. He can have everything he wants. He doesn't need these things. He's taking all this stuff from very poor people. And his anger got to a breaking point when in one particular village, a destitute woman, a very, very poor old lady, lined up and presented the Dalai Lama with a skirt, with a woman's piece of clothing. And he got so upset, he shouted at the Dalai Lama, you think of yourself as a religious person, as a leader. What sort of holy person are you? You're taking something from someone who needs it much more than you. She needs that skirt. You don't. You're a man. You've got whatever you want. What does a man need with a woman's skirt? You can see his point. But he couldn't see the Dalai Lama's point. And so the Dalai Lama had to explain it to him. He liked the calmness whenever you're abused. So actually to respond in calmness is always a wonderful gift back. He responded calmly. He said, you're right, sir. I don't need this woman's skirt. But that woman needed to give it to me. That's a wonderful observation about what giving is all about. Whenever you receive a present, if it's on your birthday or Christmas coming along now, what we call in our monastery Buddhamas, or Bud Christmas, what Ajahn Chah used to call it, it doesn't really matter whether you need those gifts. Other people need you to give it to you. When you understand the meaning of that, you understand what a benefit it is when you are sick. Other people need to care. They need to give to you. They need to look after you. And by being so sick, you're giving people the opportunity to care. That's what you're doing, I told her, later on in your bed, when you can't look after yourself at all. You're looking after other people by giving them the chance to care. And you're part of this beautiful exchange of our human energies, our human concerns for each other. That's why you're like a flower opening, because you're spreading kindness by being who you are. The sick lady in the bed who needs all this attention. What a wonderful time that is for you. So I turned what was going to be one of her greatest fears of being completely dependent upon others, turned it into a wonderful way of looking at this opportunity to generate care and compassion in the world. Because that care and compassion is another level of happiness. It's a happiness again which is based on letting go. A happiness which is much better than again watching your favorite movie. It's a happiness which lasts for your whole life whenever you remember it, which inspires us and makes this world a really beautiful place. That's what I mean about the happiness born of kindness. Which is why no matter what religion you follow, or even no religion, we all recognize those acts of kindness and virtue which exceed what we expect, but which bring so much joy and color and beauty to our life. That's what happiness is at that level, kindness and compassion. But it's not kindness and compassion which you're trying to get something out of. It's that spontaneous act where you see someone in need and you say, I'm going to give, I'm going to help, I'm going to care, even if it costs you things. And it's wonderful when, you know, you can forget your appointments, forget your food, forget what you need to do, just to care. I've got into trouble a few times because sometimes you've got some appointments, you know, have all these food offerings which I have to accept every now and again. Remember once somebody was in strife. They were actually in the hospital at Charlie Gardner's. They'd attacked their mother with their mother-in-law with a kitchen knife, and she was in hospital. I don't know how many stitches. She was going crazy. I went to sort of spend the morning with her, simply because she needed someone to help her out of her pain. Even though I missed my lunch, and I was only eating one meal a day then. And all the people who had come to offer food to me, they were very upset because I never turned up for the offering. Even though I got into trouble there, I never regretted what I did, because that person needed me. They needed me. So sometimes you have to just to give, especially when it hurts, or when it gets you into trouble, when you get late for work, because you stop to help someone in need. Sure, you might lose your job, but you gain your life. What's more important? So this is what we mean by happiness and inspiration. And I think we should get back to what happiness obviously is in our hearts and forget about the demands of society. Happiness is not about, you know, becoming the top dog in the office. And I say the top dog in the office is biting each other or barking at each other. It's not about being the most sexy man or girl around. It's not about being the wealthiest person or having your name in lights or whatever. No, that's not what happiness is. You know what happiness should be. So don't just believe the society in which you live and just, you know, believe the tabloids or believe the movies where once you save the world, you know, in these, I saw in the newspaper, Superman Returns or whatever, or whatever else is a current movie of the time. You see, it's always the same, that somebody saves the world, they find the girl, and they live happily ever after, and they think that's real happiness. But now the real happy people are not the people you actually see in the newspapers. They're not the people who do the fantastic things which get worldwide recognition. The really happy people are those little ones who help each other, who have that beautiful virtue of never harming another person and never harming themselves, and go that further with compassion, really going out to care, to contribute. When something is needed, they're there to give it, even though it hurts them. And again, when you are kind and compassionate to the point that it hurts you, you're disadvantaged personally, that's when you get the biggest benefit. What it is letting go of my own concerns. Which is also just why that these days, because people just are so independent, so self-concerned. Now, I want to look after myself. I don't want to become sick because, you know, I'm in charge of my body and I should be able to look after it. I don't want to bother other people. Other people want to be bothered. And if you just are so independent, you look after yourself, you get what's called like lonely. That's actually why that those of you who know how our monasteries work, every day we need to be fed. It's like going to the zoo, going to the monastery, and not feeding the monkeys, but feeding the monks or feeding the nuns. I think a couple of days ago on Tuesday, I went to Pinneroo, the memorial park there, to do a little ceremony for somebody's a husband who'd passed away. And I saw a sign there for "Don't feed the ducks." Because, you know, if the ducks get fed, then they sort of can sometimes die. And they had a picture of like an upturned duck there with pieces of bread or popcorn next to it. And I thought, yeah, I know, but okay, the ducks need to be fed, but people like me need to feed those ducks. So sometimes it's being a bit one-sided, just thinking about the ducks, not thinking about all the people who actually get a lot of joy, you know, feeding ducks. So even the zoo these days, you can't feed the elephant, you can't feed the monkeys. So it's wonderful having monasteries. At least that's one place where you can feed the residents. And I don't care if it makes me sick. Why is it actually, you know, many of you have been to our two monasteries, the nuns' monastery or the monks' monastery. Why is it that people bring so much food? It's crazy sometimes. I remember when one of our monks, he first went to England, and people were so happy to see a monk there that at every time they had a meal, they had huge amounts of food in the bowl. And this English guy, coming to the temple for the first time, he knew something about Buddhism, but not very much. He came right up, looked in this monk. This monk told me this, it was very embarrassing, he said. This monk looked in his bowl and said, "Bloody hell, there's enough food in there to feed a bloody army." That's what he said. And he appreciates that because sometimes that's what our bowls really do look like. You see how much food is in there. But that's not the point. The point is why we get so much food in these monasteries. It's not because we need it, because people need to give. And you get so much happiness from sharing. Even like somebody said, they went to our monastery for the first time and thought, how wonderful it is. They're a very wealthy person. How wonderful it is that we share the food here with people we don't know. Because in their life they don't only share food with their peers, with their relations. Now they share food with everybody. It's like sharing your life. It's like sharing your time. It's called sharing your heart. I remember asking people once, why do you come to our monastery to give us food? You have to get up really early in the morning to cook something. And you always cook something really special. I remember the first year we got complaints from all these husbands. Because they came and saw what we ate and said, my wife never makes that for me. Why is it they work so hard? And once they've cooked the food, they have to take it to these monasteries. It's an hour from here to Serpentine, about 40 minutes to Nuns' Monastery. I think that's probably why they get more food than we do, because it's close. No, that's only a joke. We're getting enough too much. He spent all that time, and we're the only place in our society where we invite people to lunch and they bring their own food and they also wash up after them. They even do the washing up afterwards. And sometimes we go to these restaurants sometimes to do blessings. These really nice restaurants, the top gold plate winning restaurants. Not only do they invite us there to eat for free, the best food, but they also give us a donation. They actually pay us for actually eating in their place. I mean, look upon it that way, but why do we do this? And I asked people, why do you do this? And they said, because of happiness. I knew the answer. Isn't that what happens? Because you get so happy, like sharing, and especially because monks and nuns, we are deliberately helpless. We could help ourselves. I could get a bank account and be able to order whatever I want, or cook it myself, or even buy the food ourselves, or even grow the food ourselves. Then why in monasteries don't you grow food? You've got all these acres. Nuns' Monastery, 600 acres. Why don't you plant an orchard, and then we don't need to come and feed you? Exactly. If we were self-sufficient, we'd be saying we don't need you. We'd be isolating ourselves. We're making a statement which is completely against the path of happiness. By not being self-sufficient, by being deliberately, intentionally dependent on you, we're creating this beautiful teaching. We're saying, we need you. And people respond, at last, someone needs me. And you respond by saying, thank you so much, by giving me the opportunity to be needed, to be valuable. What a wonderful thing that would be in a marriage, if we could actually tell our partner, I really need you. And you really are dependent. You can't do things by yourself. If you teach your children not to be so independent, to show that we need each other, and then we'll have a much more happy world. So happiness is not being independent. It's not getting your big stash of cash and your big mansion. All the big mansion is putting you further away from your neighbors, further away from your friends, so you feel more separated and more lonely. Which is what happens when people become rich. They become more separated from other people. Their mansions become their prison. And that's why they have all these huge walls, these bigger walls and security systems around the mansions of Dalkeith than there are around the prisons. Which is a real prison, and which is real freedom. So instead we say we need each other, we invite each other into our hearts, into our homes, into our lives, into our sicknesses. We understand that we don't need to be afraid when we become dependent upon others. I've been dependent upon others for 32 years. And I love it. It's wonderful being fed every day, being looked after, and having people fighting, literally, over, you know, what house I'm going to be given a meal in when I go to Singapore. Isn't it wonderful that that happens? What it means is people understand how to care. And that is a way of happiness. When we actually understand that happiness, happiness rises. Our whole level gets higher and higher. Sure, we have our troughs and our peaks and the disappointments of life and the exuberant moments of life, but the average happiness goes up and up and up. And as we go up and up and up, we understand that when we sort of stop thinking about me, when we start thinking about them, but we always think about us, we're in it together, then we understand just how we go higher and higher and higher. And this is actually what we do. It's called letting go. It's called leaving things alone. And the meditation also is about letting go, making peace. But still people don't get the message in meditation. They want to sort of try and shut out the world instead of trying to be at peace with the world. And there's a big difference there. Trying to shut up the world means telling your thoughts, shut up, get out of here. Trying to tell all your restless ideas, fantasies, dreams, whether to get out of here. Instead of being at one with them, being friendly to them, being kind to them, even being dependent upon them. Understanding it's sometimes the restless thoughts, which are your little teacher, which actually show you something which is very, very important. When they come, they may be unpleasant, not what you want or not what you expect. What I learned from teachers like Ajahn Chah is the things which we sometimes think aren't important, our problems or difficulties, that they're our greatest teachers. In Thailand, whenever we used to complain about the mosquitoes, he told us to call them our teachers. Ajahn Mosquito, he used to call them. If you have a boss who's giving a hard time at work, he's Ajahn Boss. If you've got a partner who's giving you a hard time, it's Ajahn Wife, Ajahn Husband, or Ajahn Mother-in-Law. And he's teaching you something, actually to learn. And that's why that we can embrace and accept these things. Because not embracing, rejecting and fighting is not letting go. It is the cause of suffering. And so when we let go more and more, and we do this in meditation. Meditation, as I'm teaching on this retreat, is a great microcosm of real life. It's not different than real life. It actually shows you how to deal with the real situations of life. You learn it in the laboratory of your mind called meditation. How to deal with an ache or pain in the body. How to deal with the sound of the dog barking outside. Look, of course that dog barks outside. What do you think it is? It's a dog. That's what dogs do. And it reminds me of one of Ajahn Chah's famous stories. He said there was a farmer who had a chicken, and he wanted the chicken to go quack quack. And he tried everything, tried to make his chicken go quack quack. And he was getting so frustrated, he was getting so upset, he had so much suffering because he wanted his chicken to become a duck. Now, how many of you have got a chicken mind and want it to be a duck mind? Wanting your mind to be something different than it is. And if you do, you get a big headache and have to take much Panadol. So, if you have a chicken, you have to allow it to be a chicken and be one with its chicken nature. If you have a duck, allow it to be a duck. So you'll find that sometimes your mind in meditation will be very restless. It'll be like a chicken mind. Sometimes it'll be a duck mind. Sometimes it'll be a very, very peaceful Buddha mind. But your job is to allow things to be. It's like people, they've got a beautiful wife, but they want their wife to be like, what is it, Angelina Jolie? Angelina Jolie's Angelina Jolie. You've got a duck. And sometimes you want your husband to be Brad Pitt, and he's a chicken. But they're all right, chickens and ducks, they're okay. So when you appreciate, and sometimes you've got a kid, and you want him to be Einstein, and you're really hanging out to see what his year 12 exam results are going to be. Any of you here who are Buddhists, you should be very embarrassed if your child comes top or in the top 5%. Didn't the Buddha teach the middle way? And to avoid extremes? So a real Buddhist kid should not be aiming for the top 5%, not aiming for the bottom 5%, but the middle way. There's a lot to be gained from being in the middle. You don't have to work so hard. The competition is not so tough. You don't get so upset, stressed out in your life, as many kids who are aspiring to be in the top 1% do. But people ask me when I say things like that, aren't you supposed to be encouraging your children to excellence and to, you know, really achieve their potential? I say, yes. Of course you're trying to inspire them to excellence and achieve their potential, but not the exam results. Your goal should be to achieve their potential in happiness, to excel in their self-worth, to achieve their peace inside. So you're aiming for the wrong things, just scores on some sort of test, or kudos of going to UWA or some other sort of elite university. Don't you want the best for your kids? Isn't the best their happiness? Understand that. You understand how one should be encouraging people to understand what happiness is and to go for that. So see if you can get not the TEE scores, but the BEE scores, the Brahm or the Buddhist educational. Well, what does TEE really mean anyway? Tertiary entrance, okay, call it NEE, Nibbana Entrance Examination. So to actually go for your happiness. And now you know roughly what happiness means. If only we could remember this. And then some of the other things we aspire for in the world, which we put so much effort into gaining, which causes so much problems and suffering and difficulties, they won't actually come up anymore. And we'll be happier, more successful people. So why can't we remember what happiness truly is? If we can remember what happiness truly is, and then we can also understand like the importance of happiness and laughter, which I was supposed to say anyway. I better go quickly here because it's also almost 9 o'clock. The joke of the day. There's this guy, he was watching the TV. He's one of these couch potatoes, all he ever does. This fat guy, feet up, just watching the TV with his six-pack next to him. drinking beer after beer after beer. And he's watching a program on euthanasia. And he turned around to his wife and said, "Look, darling, if that ever happens to me, I'm in a persistent vegetative state, and I am just dependent upon these artificial means to keep me alive, and I just have to depend upon fluids. Please just turn it all off and let me die." So she turned off the TV, took away his beer, and he died. Now that's laughter, but also makes a point, isn't it, that too many of us have just depended upon these artificial means for stimulation to keep us alive. Depend upon too much fluids, especially this time of the year. And in persistent vegetative states in front of the TV. So it's better to pull the plug. Okay, so that's the talk this evening on happiness and a little bit of on laughter. I hope you enjoyed it. That's all you're getting. Okay, any comments or questions about the talk this evening? Any questions, comments? Going. Okay, go on. So now pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.
Satipanno